the goal that I had of having the Tyler State Communion, of course, was good. But the way I went about it, in kind of a self-righteous, I can't believe you guys are not taking communion. You're back there counting money instead of taking communion.
Did you call one of them Judas?
No.
Welcome to the Stand Firm Podcast. We are recording this episode on Tuesday, December 3rd, 2024. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm here with Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, and J.D. Koch of St. Luke's Anglican Church on Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. How are you guys doing today?
Excellent.
Great, Nick.
Did you all have nice Thanksgivings? Matt, I see you survived the artichokes.
Yes, I was forced to eat them, but they didn't totally ruin Thanksgiving. There's no, I don't know why they my wife decided we're going to do courses for Thanksgiving. So I like to have a big plate full of food for Thanksgiving, but nope, we had to have courses. So we sat there for like 4 hours, had different courses come out. It was okay. It was nice, but I don't want a French Thanksgiving.
I'd much prefer a French Thanksgiving. I mean, there's a reason why restaurants don't serve turkey and stuffing and cranberry sauce as part of their regular staple.
Oh, please don't tell me. I feel like you're going to be an anti-turkey person, aren't you?
No, I like turkey. I like turkey. I mean, I like sliced turkey on sandwiches. And I like turkey fine with gravy, but I just think I'd much prefer a French one. Sounds good. I was wondering though, what are there other chokes than just artichokes, or is that the only choke in the world? I mean, it is a type of root vegetable, right?
I don't know, but
I don't think choke is some kind of suffix. I think artichoke is the name of the vegetable.
I thought it was I'm going to Google that. That's a Google. It's a Googleable thing. There's no trivia anymore.
That's
it's
true.
Straight to Google.
No question that can't be answered. I'll say that I'm not a turkey guy. I eat it, but we have a family policy of never cooking a turkey. We will happily accept an invitation to someone else's house if they're going to cook one, and we'll eat it politely, and we'll pour gravy all over it and eat the turkey meat until it's gone. But I'd much prefer a ham.
Wow, that's heresy.
You have like a decision that you made about no turkeys? Like, how did that conversation come about?
We all looked at each other and said, nobody here really likes turkey enough to go to all the work to cook one. And so, like I said, we will happily be invited to your houses and eat your turkeys. If you come to our house on Thanksgiving, you'll get ham.
So they have sun chokes, apparently, which is a variation of a... is also known as the Jerusalem artichoke. So maybe you're right. Maybe artichoke is just
the Jerusalem artichoke like hard right coated like the Jerusalem cross has become?
That's right. It's a dog whistle if you're serving artichokes. That's right. You're gonna get on some FBI watch list, if not being served by a Fed himself.
Oh boy.
What is the world coming to? Our listener is shaking his or her head.
Well, Matt, you have this new article out in the print edition. I was wondering, you couldn't get your piece in the stone tablet edition? You're in the print edition of the North American Anglican, a piece called Train Up a Pastor in the Way He Should Go, in which you claim that most Anglican clergy coming out of seminary are in no way ready to be rectors of churches, and that curacies are vanishingly rare in the ACNA. Although I should say at this point that the Diocese of Christ Our Hope does fund curacy programs in our churches, those that can handle one. So ACNA churches should begin, in your view, to form potential clergy in churches before seminary. So tell us why a curacy, either before or after seminary, or even if you're doing something online during seminary, why that's important and what you at Good Shepherd have done as a solution to this problem.
Yeah, I think it's crucial because you come out of seminary, if you haven't had any parish experience at all, your experience of church has been as a parishioner or as maybe serving in some kind of ministry, but it's never the same as it will be when you're the person that everyone looks to and everyone holds responsible for the decisions that are made and the way the church is going and the health of the church. And it's such a, I remember the feeling of whiplash I felt right out of seminary, because I was a rector right out of seminary. I've been a youth minister before, but the youth minister is the fun guy everyone likes. Yeah. And, you know, if there's a problem with the youth ministry, we'll talk to the rector and see if he can solve it.
And they complain about the rector to the youth minister, yeah, and say that they wish he was the rector.
Exactly. So don't.
I get so much more out of your sermons than I do that, that cloistered ivory tower windbag. That
So you come out and you're just not even prepared for the weight of that responsibility. It's hard for a guy who hasn't had any look at a parish, any sense of a parish life to recognize when there's a potential division brewing, is someone who's potentially going to cause a problem and that needs to be confronted. It's hard to recognize people who are just kind of annoying, but not really problems. I mean, you know, if you have a cantankerous parishioner, he or she may just be a cantankerous parishioner, but a young guy coming out of seminary might think, oh, I gotta smash this. I gotta stop this person from being so annoying. You can't tell, I guess, the difference between a threat and a non-threat. You can't figure out really, I think, without at least 2 years of experience, how to make a change that needs to be made. So by now, I've been doing it for 20 years. I know pretty much the process you need to go through, even to make a minor change. Like, oh, we're going to switch the Gloria around in the liturgy or something like that, which, you know, fine. But you have to have conversations. You have to talk to the right people. You have to make sure that people's feelings aren't going to be hurt. And you just don't know that it's coming out of seminary. So even if you've had pastoral ed classes, I had lots of pastoral education classes in seminary, but none of them prepared me for what I was going to face. So I think without that experience of the curacy used to provide, we're learning what it's like to be an ordained leader responsible for or ministries as an ordained leader, where you also have a rector over you who's helping you not do something terribly wrong, but also letting you make mistakes, showing you how to read the parish, read the situation. Without that kind of curacy, I think not only is it bad for the seminarian coming out of seminary, the newly ordained guy, but it's also bad for the church. I think it's not great for the parish to have a really inexperienced person like that, who might have a great preach great sermons and teach good Bible studies, but who can't pastor his way out of paper bag. That's not a good thing. Now, of course, some people have natural ability at that. Some people have a more intuitive sense about pastoral care than others. But I'd say it's rare to find someone who can come right out of school and lead effectively as a pastor in a church. So we decided, I mean, I, the experience of Good Shepherd taught me, we've got to figure out some way to rectify this. And we, over the course of several, many years, developed what we call the Cramner Fellows Program. We take guys before they go to seminary and give them 2 years of experience as the position used to be called pastoral assistant, not assistant pastor, but pastoral assistant. And we would give these guys experience in, you know, of course, teaching and preaching, but also like going to vestry meetings and heading up ministries in the church, interfacing with parishioners, doing visits. Those the kinds of things you'd be doing as a pastor for 2 years, while also doing some intellectual work with giving them particularly Anglican focused theological reading to do. And then by the time they go to seminary, they have had at least some sense of what it's like to be in pastoral leadership, and they can come out, and if they don't have a curacy, well, that's fine. They're still able to go somewhere and function.
So your concern, I say this as a compliment, your concern was for the broader ACNA rather than for your church, because you have been at your church for a long time and you just looked out at the broader ACNA and saw a need for better prepared clergy.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it started off when, before the ACNA was even a thing, we were founded, ACNA came about in 2009, I think. Mm-hmm. So we were already training our first guy before that. But the thought was, we didn't know what kind of structure would be there. We need to figure out a way to have young guys have experience before they get out. And we knew, like, once the ACNA did come to pass, we knew pretty assuredly that the guys we were training were going to leave us. You know, they're not going to stay a good shepherd. They're going to go somewhere else. That's the whole point. You're going to go to seminary and you're going to leave. And so that has been hard for the parish, because they're usually these young guys with families and they love them, and then they have to get up and go to seminary and leave. It's kind of hard. But yeah, I think the ACNA, because we're not the Episcopal Church in 1950, where you had tons of people and tons of money. And so most churches could afford an assistant. Even medium-sized churches could afford to have an assistant. You're just a curacy is hard to come by. I think that's maybe different in more affluent dioceses. Maybe have more of an opportunity for that. But my diocese doesn't have a lot of opportunity for that, and I know a lot of dioceses don't.
So we've actually adapted your Cranmer Fellowship for use here in Louisville. For us, it's not been so much young guys before they go to seminary. We have a very particular, almost niche need here in Louisville, where the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary is. We get a ton of people who are either in seminary or recent graduates who have become enamored of Anglicanism. So I need a discernment program to make sure, A, that the ACNA will be good for them, and B, that they'll be good for the ACNA. You and I know from our years in the Episcopal Church, one of the things that really sort of pulled the block out from in front of the giant stone that crushed the church was lack of discernment pre-ordination. I mean, I could even feel it as I went through the process myself, even though I did feel like I was called. At every stage, it was just like, aren't you guys going to ask me harder questions? Don't you care more about the future of your church? Like, I think I'll be okay, but what about all these other people going through the process with me? So for us in Louisville, we've taken what you made and adapted it a little bit, so it's less sort of preparatory for seminary and more about serving in an Anglican parish. So it still has that service element, but also a more sort of what exactly do you come to Anglicanism with? What are you expecting? What do you want the ACNA to be for you versus what the ACNA actually is? So it's been a very helpful thing for us, not exactly used in the same way, but I think serving a lot of the same purposes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, as you're talking, I was thinking through all the guys that have passed through. I don't think we've trained one guy who is a cradle Episcopalian or a cradle Anglican. They've all been people coming out
at different
denominations. And I think that's probably how the ACNA is growing right now, is people from other denominations, not by family growth.
Pure evangelism of non-Christians.
Right. Yeah. right. Exactly. No. So I'm glad you guys are doing that. I didn't know you had adopted that. So that's really wonderful. And we do right now, my current assistant is a graduate of the program, and he's also now heading it up, and he's trying to make it so that it's transferable, that other churches can take the program and run with it. It's changed dramatically in the last year, though, because of the Greystone,
which is in the article. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So Westminster Theological Seminary is a Presbyterian Reformed seminary. It has had an Anglican tract before, and some of our guys have gone through the Anglican tract. Our bishop likes to send people there, but I think it's better to have a more robust Anglican focus and a training than just a tract in a Presbyterian school. Apparently some folks at BTS or WTS thought so too. So this Greystone project is, it allows a person who is called to the ordained ministry and is going through the process with his diocese to be trained in a parish using the Cranmer program stuff for us anyway, using the Cranmer program to help him learn how to be a pastor, while at the same time taking classes remotely and earning a degree at Westminster. And so the benefit of that is you know, you got a guy like kind of like what you were explaining a minute ago. You have people who are actually in seminary who are going through your program. We would have people going through our program who are in seminary as well, but the seminary would be based at the church. I mean, that would be the place where most of the learning would be taking place. And so these guys who are going to be coming through in the future, they will have, I think Westminster is a 4-year degree, 4 solid years of pastoral training alongside getting the stuff you really need to be a good preacher and teacher from Westminster. And I think that's even better than having a curacy afterwards or a preparation period before, because you get to integrate what you're learning academically with what you're doing pastorally on the spot as you're going.
That's the equivalent of like a field work course in a residential seminary, where you at least theoretically take what you learn in the classroom and apply it to a local church. Obviously, it's not the same when you're not in the church for years at a time. Now, obviously, we can probably talk at length about the advantages of residential seminary versus online seminary and being in church. JD, what's going through your mind?
Well, I'm sympathetic. I liked your article, Matt, and obviously it's not obvious, but I think anyone that's been ordained and been a rector has walked through some of those experiences, the small and the large ones, and hopefully lived to tell the tale, whether in that church or in another. But I think, my first reaction was that I don't think there's any way to prepare someone for the dual reality of both being, a called ordained person to a particular call, and then also deal with the sort of human aspect of feeling not just responsible, but also vulnerable in a way that, I'm just not sure you can prepare for that. Although I do think that, speaking frankly and openly and with people that are in the ordination process, not seminary, about the challenges they'll face when they go from, sort of participating in church to being responsible for it. Those are helpful conversations, and I was grateful in the Church of England, at least they have a mandatory, at least when I went through, I don't know if it still exists, 3-year curacy training. So you were called a curate, and that gave you a little bit of leeway, because the parish knew what that meant. The rector knew what that meant. I didn't really know what it meant, but I was grateful that I was able to, claim ignorance or sort of throw my hands up and say, I'm just the curate, so don't blame me. And so, I think that it's, the more we talk about it, like I appreciate the sort of triage need at the moment that you're filling with the Cranmer's program that you're talking about. But I still think that, a healthy denomination needs healthy seminaries. And I think it needs clearinghouses where you get out of your local context and actually interact not just with a new context, but also with your future colleagues. And, you're sort of, to use the proverb, sharpening iron in that, and preparing yourself, which is, we have a hard time down here in South Carolina, preparing yourself to be sent to places other than where you were formed. This is one of the challenges. Like, we have a hard time getting people to leave, the low country and go to Arizona or somewhere much different geographically, if not culturally. And I think that there's something positive about being taken out and set apart and given to study and formation over a number of years. Now, I've always been attracted to the LCMS model, which has a gap year, essentially, or in their third year of seminary, they go back to their parish as they call it a vicar, the vicariat. So they have a vicarage year where they actually are sort of doing what you're talking about, Matt. They've got some intellectual has been fed in that way. So they're not coming sort of just totally fresh theologically, but at the same time, they're not fully ordained, and yet they are given responsibilities. And so they spend a year putting into practice all these things that they've been learning. And then they go back to seminary and sort of have, at least as far as I can tell, what we did at CP, Nick, like they sit around and talk about like what, maybe I shouldn't have. What is it always gets me in trouble is I change the prayers of the people, and that's just like, that is... Or we added the psalm, you know, added the psalm, and you would have thought I, you know, had defaced someone's ancestral grave or something. Like, we never say the psalm. That's not in this church. That was in a much, much different church, a long way away. But, you know, I think that it's a challenge that we're all facing. And I appreciate what I think your instincts are right, Matt, obviously, and you've learned a lot, and it's important to share that. And I commend the program you're doing. I just personally think that, you know, it's like, as a board member at Trinity Anglican Seminary, we keep talking about the fact that, you know, if the ACNA can't staff have a full complement of students for at least one seminary, you know, for the entire province, then, you know, we're in trouble. I mean, I think we're and so I, again, that's not necessarily, well, it is an advertisement for Trinity Anglican, but, you know, if we're going to have a continent wide or a nationwide province, you know, we're going to hopefully be able to fill 2, 3, 4 seminaries, if not more. And we're not talking about thousands of people. You're talking about 25, 30 a class. And so, you know, I think that's a separate conversation perhaps, but I think that the challenges you're talking about, I do think need to be addressed, and the deficiency of just seminary without some sort of field work needs to be corrected. And so I think, you know, whether we look at encouraging churches that can afford them to make a specific mission for a curacy program, you know, with the express intent of you're here for, you know, that's like what the Falls Church does. They call it the Timothy program. I think, you know, they take ordained people, and it's known that, like, I think it's a set 3-year process. Like, you're going to be here for 3 years, and the third year you're going to plant or you're going to leave. You know, maybe we hope for churches that have those resources to do more like that, you know, diocesan initiatives and things. I mean, we're sort of doing that by default here, just because we have we have 3 priests. And so one of them, the junior priest, you know, I assume when, you know, he's a little bit older and he's perfectly capable, but, you know, we'll expect him to, when the openings come up, to hopefully move in, you know, whenever that is. And so, yeah, those are some of my initial thoughts about it. I mean, I winced a little bit at some of your examples because I've walked right through them myself.
And tripped right over them.
Yes. And you know, you don't want to get cynical about people, but you do. Like, I thought the long extended one about if you haven't read the article yet, talking about changing the way that people, like, collect money, for instance, in the church, you know, that's just a hard learn lesson, because there's so many levels of people's connection to the church that are sort of, you know, codified and ritualized, and to change them, you know, the old adage about the color of the carpet, you know, being such a dividing factor. Well, you never know if, you know, someone's great grandmother, her last bequest was to buy the new green shag carpet for the, you know, down the middle of the aisle. And so, you know, if you just sort of flippantly mentioned that it looked like a disco den from the Brady Bunch or whatever, like, next thing you know, you got 20 people leaving. I mean, that stuff happens. And so, you know, just gotta, and that's just something you know, you'd like to think that we all have the emotional intelligence to pick up on immediately, but sometimes you just got to learn it.
Matt, I've got a question for you. You say in the article that one of the potential outcomes of a Cranmer Fellowship is that the fellow ends the program deciding not to pursue ordination and, you know, quote unquote, just becomes a good congregant of a church. How do you think about parish discernment? Now, there's a diocesan process, at least for us, where that there's a formal parish discernment process. One of the real trials I think that churches have is to discern honestly young men that they know well. How do you navigate the distinction between, like, I would even love to, like, send potential Cranmer fellows from our church to you and have yours here so that we could discern them and you could discern ours, so that there's not that, gosh, I really like this kid, yeah, and I hate the idea of saying no to him, but that's not really practical. How does your church walk through that?
Yeah, I think it was, I don't know how it's going to work going forward with the Greystone program. It's not the Greystone program. I should say what it is correctly. It's the Greystone Theological Institute, is what it's called. And before that, those 2 years prior to seminary, I think the length that the 2 years was really helpful in this, because yeah, everyone who came up through that program was beloved in the parish. People gave them a lot of mercy and a lot of leeway, but we had several guys at the end of the 2 years who nobody thought they should go to seminary, and I didn't think so either. Because they tried out all the different varieties of ministry that you're going to do, and they didn't like it, and it showed they didn't like it, and the people didn't like them doing it.
It's when it's clear.
Yeah, for us, we have not had one. We have not had a case, and I'm not saying it won't happen. I'm sure it will. We've not had a case where a guy really wanted to go forward and the parish said, no, you can't go forward. So I can't say that we would, this program effectively and necessarily always weeds that out. But I do think the length, that two-year length was helpful in coming to those kinds of conclusions. Going back to one thing JD was talking about, I hear you about seminary, and I did appreciate, even though I went to VTS, a very liberal, I did appreciate the friendships I made and the chance to have 3 years isolated to just devote my mind to study and academic work. And I think that's, for some people, that's really a great thing. I do think, though, that I wouldn't describe the Greystone Institute or the Cranmer Fellowship as a stopgap measure. I think it's, I'm not sure if you said stopgap or whatever it was, but
triage.
Yeah. I want more churches to do this permanently. And even if there are more curacies, because I do think it's a better way in general to train pastors. I know that, like I said, I think for some bad academic, especially for them, some coming from bigger churches or people or from places that, people who've had parish experience, people who have been in serious leadership roles in a parish, I think, yes, go away for 3 years. But even with more curacies, I think it would be more effective. I think it's more effective for people to train in-house and get their degree and start serving the church after that. I'm not a big fan of, and maybe this is probably geographical. Like you're in South Carolina, right? You have a lot of, yeah, if I were in South Carolina, I wouldn't want to leave either. But where I am, if you're in Binghamton, everyone wants to leave, right? And you have a lot of really bad, bad heretical churches up here, and a lot of people who have no knowledge of Jesus at all. So, of course, and people are free to go where they want, but one of our hopes is that coming through the program in a place like Binghamton, will give young men a heart for the dead areas of the Northeast and want to serve closer rather than far, further away. Yes, missionary work is great, but sometimes the biggest mission field is your city, your neighborhood.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's what I'm hoping with that. Another thing you mentioned that I might read this part out because it was this is one of my first big dumb things that I did when I was young. This happened before the sexuality crisis broke out. So I was like months old in my ministry. And I wrote about this experience. I didn't say that it was my experience until the end of the account, but this is my experience, something that I did. So I'll just read it to you. But what the new rector often does not understand, I certainly didn't, is that because the church is a spiritual entity and people in the church are spiritual beings, everything in the parish is imbued with meaning. When, for example, you decide that it is better for the tellers not to take the offerings back to the office to begin counting the money immediately after the offertory and before the Eucharist, so that whoever is scheduled for that task misses communion, but that they should perform their duties after they have been nourished by the sacrament for the good of their own souls, you should be prepared. You should know that Mr. Jones, the head teller, who has grown up in the parish and who is now 72 years old, who has personally trained the tellers and designed the counting procedure to ensure the Lord's offerings are handled carefully and responsibly, who feels deeply in his heart the joy of his service, may very well be insulted. He may feel that you have accused him and all the tellers of making light of Holy Communion. He may come away with the sense that you would have him handle the gifts of the people of God cavalierly, or that you know have no regard for the time it will take the tellers after services to carry out their duties. the oddly specific details in the above case should tell you that I write from experience. And that definitely happened. And that was a big fight. I offended this guy in a serious way. And it took some doing to unoffend him. And not just him, but like all the families connected with him and all the people who loved him. And it was really bad. And it was my bad. It was the goal that I had of having the Tyler State community, of course, was good. But the way I went about it, in kind of a self-righteous, I can't believe you guys are not taking communion. You're back there counting money instead of taking communion.
Did you call one of them Judas?
No, I didn't. But I was so incredulous at the practice about how can you guys do this, that it came across as super insulting and demeaning and belittling and so yeah, it was a good lesson.
Yeah, I learned that the hard way in many ways. I basically try to project like 6 to 8 months out any change at all that I'm making, no matter how relative. Well, some I don't, but if it's going to be the possibility of, you know, rankling anyone's feathers or inadvertently offending one, like I sort of soft open it for months and months and months. I usually start with a joke or something, you know, like, oh, would it be so funny if we did this, you know, or something, and then see how people react. I was just kidding. Just kidding. We're not going back to the 79 prayer book. It's a joke. It's a joke. No, it's a, you know, I don't know, Matt. I have to think more about this. I mean, I appreciate the, you know, local option, and I appreciate the way that, you know, the need that you have in your particular diocese are being met by your program. And so I don't want to disparage that at all. But I still think that given a healthy church with enough resources and time and a functioning discernment process, that there's something to the, again, like I said before, the clearinghouse aspect of a centralized seminary system, which does in fact begin to produce similar, for lack of a better word, products or formed people that have been formed in a similar way, so that when they're sent to a church in Scottsdale or Binghamton or Hilton Head, they're actually replicating something of a recognizable Anglican worship in a church, you know. And I think that's one of the challenges. Well, that was one of the positives of the Episcopal Church, is that it didn't matter, you know, where you came from. Once you got, you know, formed through VTS or SWANI or CDSP or Yale or wherever, then you, you know, you got sent wherever, and the Episcopal churches were fairly homogenous wherever you were sent. So whether it was, you know, St. Louis or New Orleans or Binghamton, you know, for a generation or two, it was the same type people, same socioeconomic level, for lack of a better word. And so it was able to sort of replicate itself. And so we obviously have a lot of different challenges and a lot of different sociological factors going into the ACNA. And I don't want to say that we all have to look exactly the same. You know, we have to have the same sort of high church, low church, broad church, whatever. But in terms of theological voice and in terms of emphases, and I think that there's something to this kind of standardized, like I said before, like centralized formation process. And I think that's what I'm hoping. Like when I'm at Trinity, you know, my appeal to the board, and then hopefully that will become the case, is that, you know, I look at the seminary system, like the military academies in the U.S., you know, and there's certainly, you can train at home. You can go to a sort of a, you know, kind of base level, like Citadel or VMI or whatever. But traditionally, if you were going to be groomed for high level leadership, you went to West Point, you know, for instance. And so, you know, so the idea from the seminary formation system is that I think that the 3-year residential is, you know, has been the model, and at its best, I believe, is still the gold standard. That being said, obviously, you know, you may disagree, but also the facts on the ground may necessitate something different for a time, or maybe in perpetuity. But, you know, it's my hope that we get churches that are strong enough, like I said before, to support seminaries with students, you know, to actually have congregations that require more than one priest. And you know, I would love to see younger men going to seminary to begin the process earlier, because even if you did this curacy program, I mean, as you know, and an old priest once told me that, you know, it took him 10 years to figure out, after being ordained, what it even meant to be a priest, you know? And so I think, and I sort of resemble that remark myself. I mean, I'm grateful that you know, I had some good training and was not, you know, just spouting heresy for the first 10 years of my ministry. But I certainly look back at some of the instincts that had to be formed, some of the, you know, decisions that I wish I had made or hadn't made. And just frankly, some of the sort of theological thoughts or emphases that I had that I don't now. And I'm grateful that I wasn't just unleashed in the full soul responsible party, you know, right out of seminary, but instead was at least for, I guess, what, 5 years, at least had somebody over me who could shut the door behind me and say, sit down, son, we need to talk, you know. And that was, I'm grateful for that. And I hope for that for in whatever capacity for anyone that goes into the ordained ministry. You want to tell us all the mistakes you've made, Nick?
Too many to enumerate here. I can say that I think that not to, you know, play the middle ground here, but I think that I benefited greatly from my 3 years as at a residential seminary. I think that at least for me, if I had had online classes in the church that I was serving at the time, I would not have benefited nearly as much. I took one online class while I was in seminary, and I'm just not the kind of student who applies myself any more than I have to, I guess. And in a class face-to-face with a teacher and other students, I have to apply myself in a way that the online class just didn't make me. And so I did not get as much out of it. And so I think a full program like that would not have helped me. So for me, the 3 years away at school in the sort of crucible of academic formation combined with an either pre or post, whether it's a curacy or a Cranmer fellowship or the like, really, I do think scratches both of these itches in a good way that I do think can be rolled out in perpetuity in the ACNA, that our diocese actually puts a financial priority on funding these kinds of curacies for churches that otherwise couldn't afford them. Obviously, they don't have infinite money either, but whenever they can, and when they have a rector who can do it, they try to provide this opportunity for younger ordained folks to learn the ropes before they get sent out on their own. And I was blessed and cursed to be the associate rector of a wild and crazy Episcopal church right out of seminary, which helped me learn all these lessons and strengthen my backbone and gave me my white beard much earlier than I would have ordinarily had it. But as crazy as it was, I had to walk through all these same things and make all these same mistakes. And the combination, I think, was really worthwhile for me. The curacy in a church added on to the 3 years of residential seminary was really where it was at for
me. Well, I personally think that's the gold standard. I mean, I think that's been tried and true. Of course, you know, things may change, but, you know, and I think that's another argument for people going to seminary, you know, churches discerning younger people, as they can, not just because you need more time to develop and season, but also because it's a heck of a lot easier to live on nothing when you're single, if not a newlywed, than it is when you're, you know, you've got, three or four kids and, you know, perhaps in high school or beyond, or you've got its other, encumbrances, you know, cause I mean, Laz and I think when we got married, we both worked for Focus. She was technically my employee at the time. And I think we made like $31,000 a year. And somehow, you know, we were like, well, we'll figure it out, you know? And it was, and so, you know, that was a beautiful romantic time, but I couldn't do that. You know, if you asked me to do that now, of course we couldn't. And so I think it's all of the reasons why, you know, Matt, you're addressing a need in the way that, you know, I think is obviously admirable and is functioning. But I think that however it's met, the need exists. And that is to find a way to combine, you know, intellectual formation with actual practical pastoral teaching and mentoring. And so, you know, I think like at Trinity, for instance, because we have the Diocese of Pittsburgh right there, there are a ton of churches that seminarians can connect to. I mean, Nick and I did my field service all in like a 3 month period of the church. Nick ended up the one he was referencing, the one in Jersey City, which was very instructive for all sorts of reasons. But he was doing his field base at a church in Glenshaw, Pennsylvania, which we helped lead the worship with them over the time there. And that was, that was giving you some formative insights into the pastoral work, you know. So I think it's a challenge, you know, but it's a worthy one and it's an important one. And I think that your article will be edifying for people that have been rectors for a while and people that are about to be going into the process, because it certainly illustrates the particular challenge of being called to a pastoral leadership of a group of people that, you know, are that you love and that you're called to feed, and that nevertheless you will inadvertently offend or hurt at times. And navigating that is a real challenge, but it's a worthy one because that's the call of a pastor.
Yeah, three things here. First, you know, I think Nick, you're right about remote classes. For some people, it's difficult, but also technology is getting a lot better. Online courses are not what they were.
That's probably true.
Even 10 years ago.
Are you saying I'm old? No.
Yeah, now you just put on your meta glasses and you
right.
can walk right
there.
Into the classroom. That's right.
So well, my kids are in Memoria Academy, which is an online high school. At least three of them are. The rest of them are in college now. But and this is an interactive classroom. There are relationships that are forming. There are teachers know you. You know the teachers. So it's not like you know, popping in a video, watching it, taking notes, and going away. There's actual interaction and give and take, and teachers looking over your work. It's really good. Really good.
You're saying so it's not like my online class in 2004.
Right. So I think that might be that make the prospect of building relationships among colleagues more doable because the technology is better. Second, I mean, I think this is why I think it's good we have bishops, because a bishop, we're talking in broad categories here, but a bishop, when he's considering putting someone forward for ministry, will hopefully know that who the person is, and say, oh, okay, well, I see Jack here. He's been in a parish. He's been working in a parish for 5 or 6 years. He's had a lot of leadership experience in the parish. He knows what parish life is like. So I can send him to this 3-year seminary here to study. Oh, but here's Jim. You know, he hasn't had any kind of experience. He hasn't done much at all pastorally. So I'm going to send him to an in-house training program where he can get the same academic training and get the hands-on experience. So I don't want to say you're wrong, but I don't say that the 3-year or 4-year seminary and then curacy or the pre-seminary curacy is the gold standard. I think it will depend on who the person is and what the need is for the person. I think what we're developing is going to be well, first of all, it hasn't really been done in the purposeful way it's being done now. So we'll see. Maybe it'll all collapse and be bad. But I would think that we might have two gold standards, and it just depends on who the person going through is. And I had a third thing to say, but I forgot what it was. So
maybe we should have a competition of some sort, you know, like 10 years out, we'll have a...
We'll each choose a young man, a 5-year-old boy, and race it. There'll be a sword in the stone at the end.
That's right. Yeah. To prepare a service, preach a sermon, no shorter than 45 minutes, bury someone, baptize a baby, and then...
It'll be like a decathlon.
That's exactly
one
right.
Day,
that's right. Ecclesiastical decathlon. I love it. How far can you get that asperger to fling out? Like, it'll be really, really could be glorious. I like it.
Well, that's going to be all the time that we have this week. Thanks for listening to Stand Firm. If you want to keep the conversation going, you can be in touch with us. Rate and review the podcast on iTunes. Send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com. Follow us on social media. Join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Once again, please register for J.D. Koch's upcoming conference in February there in Hilton Head. Thanks to J.D. Koch and Matt Kennedy. I'm Nick Lannon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.